This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington. It was almost 5 years ago to the day that Mukhtar al-Bakri was arrested in Bahrain on his wedding night. A few days later, five of his friends were also arrested thousands of miles away in the small town of Lackawanna, New York. The Lackawanna Six, as they became known, eventually stood trial and were convicted of providing material support to al-Qaeda. Their story is the subject of a new book called The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six, and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. It's by NPR's FBI correspondent Dina Temple-Raston. She explores how six American-born citizens could end up in an al-Qaeda training camp just months before the 9/11 attacks on the United States. It's also a story about Americans' fears of both homegrown terrorism and how the U.S. justice system is responding to those fears. Author Dina Temple-Raston joins us now here in Studio 3A. Welcome to the program, Dina.
Thanks for having me.
You can talk to Dina as well if you have questions about the case of the Lackawanna Six or how homegrown terror is dealt with in the United States. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Dina, before we talk about the Lackawanna Six, we want to touch briefly on a developing story. FBI Director Robert Mueller and other administration officials testified before the Senate today, giving an update on the terrorist threat to the United States. Here's Robert Mueller in his opening statement.
While much of the United States government's attention is focused on, and rightfully so, on al-Qaeda's reach from abroad into the United States, homegrown radicalization also exists. The role of our law enforcement partners is absolutely critical to identifying individuals and groups presenting this threat, especially through the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Forces, of which are over 100 today.
Dina, you've been monitoring these hearings today. Is this issue of homegrown terrorism of increasing concern to the U.S. government 6 years after 9/11?
I would say yes, and the reason being that it's the hardest kind of terrorism to ferret out because the people who may be wanting to do this sort of thing, homegrown terrorists, look just like you and me. And this is actually one of the big points of the book. If you had seen these six young men at any other time, you never would have believed in a million years that they would have attended an al-Qaeda camp. And even after they came back, they acted completely normally. And people in the community were aghast that they might have actually gone. In fact, they thought it was all a setup until the evidence started to dribble out.
Mm-hmm. What else did you hear in today's testimony about how we're confronting the threat of homegrown extremism?
Well, he didn't focus on it intensely. I think he was trying to make the point that this is sort of the next wave of where the investigations need to be going, and that there are a lot of tools that they need to develop to actually be able to do this. One of the big things the FBI has been doing is doing a lot of outreach to the Muslim community, and this has been incredibly helpful to them. It's given them tips on a number of different so-called homegrown terrorism plots that have started to unfold, and it's allowed the Joint Terrorism Task Force, local police, and the FBI to actually thwart what could be, you know, reasonably large attacks.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get on to your new book. It is titled The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six, and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. Refresh our memory. Just who are the Lackawanna Six?
You know, when I started this book, when I would ask people, do you remember the Lackawanna Six? People inevitably said, weren't they the guys who went to the al-Qaeda camp and weren't they terrorists? Mm-hmm. Or it was just the opposite. People would say, yeah, they were accused of going to an al-Qaeda camp, but they were railroaded, weren't they? It was all political. In fact, the truth is somewhere in between. What happened is six young men from this steel town of Lackawanna in New York went from New York to Pakistan and then into Afghanistan and went to the al-Qaeda camp that we usually see on TV, the one with the monkey bars and the men in hoods who are doing an obstacle course. This is, in fact, the camp that they went to. And they were there for weeks, not months, and in almost every case, they actually faked injuries to leave when they realized that the camp was something that wasn't advertised. They thought it was going to be sort of a Muslim jihad camp that would maybe take a look at being a fighter in Chechnya or being a fighter in Bosnia. And when the tone of the camp actually took on an increasingly anti-American tone, they got actually frightened. And we have to remember that this all took place 6 months before 9/11. And 6 months before 9/11, if you went to a camp, I think there was a very bright line between going after 9/11 and before.
Let's talk a little bit about how these guys from Lackawanna, young men, undistinguished in any way, really, how did they get involved? How did they get lured to this camp in Afghanistan?
What drew me to the story is that essentially they are like a textbook case of the way young men would be recruited into one of these jihadist camps. They actually were wooed by an Al-Qaeda recruiter who had come to Lackawanna. He had been born in Lackawanna and then left. His name was Kamal Dervish, and left to essentially grow up in Saudi Arabia and then came back as a bit of a hero in the Muslim community in the first ward of Lackawanna. And he came back for a very specific reason. He wanted to see if he could recruit men from what he called virgin territory in the first ward of Lackawanna to go and become jihadists for an Al-Qaeda camp. And this is important because they have what's gold for an Al-Qaeda operative is to actually have a American passport. The American passport suddenly gives them a freedom that to now Al-Qaeda really hasn't had. And this is sort of the next wave that everyone's mm-hmm. so worried about.
So that made them very valuable recruits.
Incredibly. Even if they weren't very good as jihadist soldiers. I mean, actually, they didn't like the heat or the food or the obstacle courses and were always whining. But because they had these American passports, a lot of the things that might have gotten them bounced out of the program otherwise allowed them to stay in the camp.
Mm-hmm. But they were lured by a particular man, Mr. Dervish, who sort of had a more romantic narrative of Islam than they had heard in their local mosque.
Exactly. And he was very alluring for that way. He came back sort of as a prodigal son, you know, who had gone to Saudi Arabia, and people knew vaguely of him. And then he came back and he spoke Arabic and he knew a lot about the Quran. And he had sort of an understanding of Islam that no one locally really had. This is a very blue-collar town. The Yemenis there had come to Lackawanna to work in the steel mills. And the kind of brand of Islam that they practiced was more earnest than erudite. And Kamal Dervish, although was not a genius, comparatively, he knew a lot about Islam, and they found this very alluring.
And what do you think made them decide to go? What was it? Was it something about their life at home? Was it something about the adventure that was promised? Was it because they were extremists?
I would go with the fact that they were very adventurous. You know, I actually followed in their footsteps precisely from Yemen to Pakistan into the jihadi hotels where they stayed and then across the border into Afghanistan to the precipice of where this camp was. And I've traveled a lot, and I got wrapped up in the adventure of it all. There's sort of a Wild West feeling to it. I was in a burqa. They were similarly disguised as Mujahideen. They were using code names. They were meeting people who would move them from place to place. It all seemed very James Bond to them. And they said that afterwards, that it was very James Bond. But once they got to the camps and they started hearing all this anti-American rhetoric, the sort of James Bondian character to it got very real and very frightening.
We want to talk a little bit more about what it was like in the camps, but we want to remind you that you can talk to us. We're talking to our NPR FBI correspondent, Dina Temple-Raston, about her new book, The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. You can ask her some questions, too, if you call 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can send us an email there. Dina, what was it like in these camps? What did these young men from Lackawanna find when they got there?
Well, they started out in a guest house. And in the guest house, their passports were taken from them, their clothes were taken from them, any belongings that they brought were taken from them. And they were given this Mujahideen garb, basically head coverings and sort of army-like fatigues. And they waited there several days, and then they were finally put on buses and bussed out further into the dunes to where the camp was. And they didn't like the heat, they didn't like the bad food, they didn't like to be sleeping on rocks, and it was hard work. They had to get up very early in the morning for morning prayer, and then they were run around all day long, and sort of the same sort of thing that we hear from new recruits at boot camp, you know, their spirits are broken down so that they can rebuild them. It's very much the same thing at an Al-Qaeda camp.
And what kind of activities? Were they involved in explosives? Were they shooting firearms? What kind of training exactly did they get?
Well, there's actually something called the Encyclopedia of Jihad, which lays out exactly how a camp is supposed to operate. And there are large sections of this in the book that sort of explain how they go about creating a jihadist. And one of the things that they do is they teach them about guns. They teach them about how to assassinate someone from the back of a motorcycle. They teach them plastic explosives. And they went through a lot of these different training segments. And for them, it was fun to blow something up. Or they dry-fired most of the guns because they didn't have enough ammunition. But still, this was, you know, teaching them the basic components of what you needed to be a violent jihad fighter.
But they also bridled against some of the rules and structure of the camp. They really didn't like it there.
No, they didn't. I mean, in the same way that they bridled at a lot of the rules that they had when they were high school students. I mean, these were not disciplined young men. These were a little bit wild. And one of the reasons why they were able to be brought into the fold and sent to the and agreed to go to the Al-Qaeda camp was because they were told they were bad Muslims because of their wildness. And they were trying to right that. But that wildness didn't end overnight. They tried very hard to be disciplined like they were supposed to be at the Al-Qaeda camp, but their natures were not really that way.
Again, you can give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us an email at talk@npr.org, and we'll get your questions for Dina Temple Rostin. We're speaking with Dina Temple Rostin about her book, The Jihad Next Door. You can send us an email at talk@npr.org or call us at 800-989-TALK. I'm John Aitsty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Aitsty in Washington. We're talking about the Lackawanna Six this hour and the search for so-called homegrown terror in the United States. NPR's FBI correspondent Dina Temple Rostin is with us. Her new book about the Lackawanna Six is called The Jihad Next Door. You can read an excerpt from the book about Mukhtar al-Bakri's wedding and his arrest later that day at our website, npr.org/talk. And, of course, we want to hear from you. If you have questions for Dina about terror in this country or about the Lackawanna Six, you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And, Dina, one of the high points and most unusual experiences that these young men had while they were at this Al-Qaeda training camp was that they met Osama bin Laden. And you write about that very vividly in your book. I wonder if you could read part of that passage.
I'd be happy to. Let me set it up a little bit. They had only just arrived in the camps at this time. They're starting, having been at the guest house, they're starting to understand what it is they've gotten themselves into. And I'll just jump in here. The sun was setting on the camp when the trainers began gathering guns, disarming sentries, and tugging Kalashnikovs from the hands of recruits who were reluctant to give them up. They instructed their charges to cover their faces. There were going to be cameras filming, they said. All we want is to see your eyes. Then, out of the desert, trailing sand and dust behind them, three four-wheel drive Land Cruisers and four-door pickups raced up to the camp. Trainers in the hills and on the rooftop of the mosque began firing their weapons in the air as a celebratory greeting. Rocket-propelled grenades flew skyward. For many minutes, the noise of the ammunition was deafening. The Lackawanna boys suppressed the urge to take cover and craned their necks to see who had arrived. The guards emerged first. Armed to the teeth, they fanned out around the vehicles. They were wearing camouflage vests. Their faces were covered. Though what caught the eye of the Lackawanna Six was the weaponry they carried. There were Kalashnikovs and rocket-propelled grenades. There were long magazines of bullets and handguns. Bin Laden, all one whispered under his breath. Then the sheik emerged.
Could you skip now to the paragraph on the next page? Osama bin Laden swung out of the car.
Osama bin Laden swung out of the car, bending almost double to squeeze his frame out of the small door opening. He was trailed by Alman al-Zawahiri, the man who would emerge as his second in command. Born into a prominent middle-class family in the suburb of Cairo, Zawahiri was the leading organizer of a radical Islamic jihadist in Egypt. He had fought, like bin Laden, in the Afghan resistance against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. The Lackawanna Six had never heard of him and didn't recognize him, but the way he moved around bin Laden suggested he was someone important.
Let me ask you to read just one more paragraph on the next page, 119, second paragraph there, which talks about the response of one of the Lackawanna Six, Yassim Tahir.
Yassim Tahir was voted friendliest in his high school class at Lackawanna High School and was a star soccer player. And he's now sort of taking cover as all this is going on, and he watches as bin Laden gets out of the car and moves into the mosque and follows him in. While Tahir didn't understand everything bin Laden said, bin Laden was speaking Arabic. He recalled later that bin Laden was hinting that there were 40 men prepared to, quote, take their souls into their hands, unquote, to carry out suicide bombing missions against the United States and Israel. Tahir swallowed hard and exchanged glances with his friends. Alwan, in particular, looked shocked. The men were told to remain in the mosque while Osama bin Laden departed. He and his entourage left Al-Farouk camp through the back gate, disappearing in their Toyotacade over the hill and into the desert. The Lackawanna Six were part of a small handful of Americans to have ever seen bin Laden in person. The meetings with him would come to haunt them.
And this was a year before 9/11.
Exactly.
Let's go to a caller now, a caller in Buffalo. Hello, Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. I really don't have a question. Yassim Tahir worked for me for some time, actually, right before he got arrested. He was still in my employ.
Hmm.
Very good kid. Work on time. I even made religious accommodations for him where he would go into the computer room to pray during his shift. But definitely not a terrorist.
Not a terrorist.
No, not at all. He's a young kid. I mean, I never knew that he had gone away to a camp or anything like that, but just his interaction with the employees, just a very kind-hearted, good kid.
Did he work for you?
By no means, you're a terrorist.
Did he work directly for you, Chris?
That's correct.
So you got to know him?
Yeah, every day.
So and what day kind of work was it?
I'm sorry?
What kind of work did he do for you?
Collections, debt collections.
Mm-hmm. And did he work for you after he came back from the camps or before he left?
Actually, I believe it was during, if my dates are correct. He had been in my employ for what was well over a year, probably 2 years. Then he was arrested. We came to work. We're like, oh, what happened to him? And this all came out with the Lackawanna Six. I actually interviewed another gentleman, a Shafal Mossad, that I didn't hire, which was a friend of his, which also turned out to be one of the Lackawanna
Six. Another one of the Lackawanna Six.
Yeah, I didn't hire him, but Yassim was a great guy. I mean, mm-hmm. Really. You picture this terrorist running around with rifles. This was a young kid. He had to be in his early 20s. And, it's kind of a shame what happened. I think he got kind of pulled into the hype of the time and, be he the target at the time or whatever. This gentleman was no threat to the United States.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. I appreciate your time, and I love your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So Chris says Yassim Tahir was not a terrorist, but the U.S. government had other ideas and decided that he was. Tell us about how these young men finally returned and then were arrested.
Well, even before they returned, what happened is an anonymous letter from the Muslim community in Lackawanna went to FBI agent Ed Needham. And basically it said, I'm a member of the Muslim community in Lackawanna. I'm writing you an anonymous letter. And there are some young men from Lackawanna who have actually gone to Afghanistan to train in Al-Qaeda camp. So before they even came back, the FBI was on to them. And in fact, they were briefly stopped in John F. Kennedy Airport when they came back through. And the FBI was watching them for the moment they came back for more than a year. And in fact, Yassim Tahir in a lot of ways is the most heartbreaking of the men, because he clearly is a very sweet young guy. He was voted friendliest in his high school class. He was a soccer player. He actually ended up marrying his childhood sweetheart, who was a white girl who actually converted and became Muslim for him. She was the head cheerleader, and he was the soccer team captain. It was
a
very all-American story, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Tell us a little bit more about how the arrest took place, what kind of monitoring there was, and particularly just running up to the arrest, there were a couple of very interesting intercepts that the FBI made. A phone call and an email from a young man named Mukhtar al-Bakri.
Mukhtar al-Bakri had actually gone to Bahrain to marry a teenage bride that his father had set him up with.
This is after they came back from the camps, a year later.
It would have been more than a year later. It would have been almost 18 months later, because this was in September of 2002. And there are some things about the story that don't quite add up. And one of them was an email that al-Bakri sent shortly before his wedding, which was supposed to be, which actually occurred on September 9th, 2002. And in this email, he said that there would be a big meal, and it went down as the big meal email. And it sort of was menacing. It talked about something big was going to happen, and it seemed
talked
to be
talked about it in religious terms.
In religious terms, mm-hmm. And it seemed to be using some of the same code language that by that time the FBI was used to having al-Qaeda operatives use amongst each other. So the truth was that the email frightened them. There was the timing of the email as well. At that time, there was a great deal of chatter in the run-up to the first anniversary of 9/11, in which people were sure that there was going to be another attack. And in particular, the CIA and the FBI seemed to be thinking that the attack was going to occur at U.S. bases overseas, probably in the Middle East. So the fact that al-Bakri was actually in Bahrain at the time and was writing this rather odd email about the big meal was problematic. Then on top of that, he called his friends, and he before he got married, he called some friends in Lackawanna and said, you know, I called to say goodbye. And a lot of the language he was using to anyone who was on a heightened state of alert, which at the time FBI investigators were, sounded like the goodbye of a suicide bomber. Now, al-Bakri said later that he was basically closing one chapter of his life, the wild chapter of his life with his friends in Lackawanna, and was determined to be a very diligent husband. And that was what was behind this. He was taking the marriage even more seriously and more dramatically than you might otherwise. And these boys in general, now men, I guess, were actually exaggerated things a lot and sort of blew things up. So it's not that much of a stretch that he was saying that his life was changing completely because of a marriage.
And by this time, the Lackawanna Six had gotten the attention of the FBI director and of the president and the vice president.
In fact, by this time, the FBI director was briefing the president and vice president daily on what was going on with the Lackawanna Six. And they actually got reports from FBI locally in Buffalo three times a day telling them what was going on with these guys. And they started towards the end, I think, that the Lackawanna Six knew that they were being watched. I'm not sure they understood why, but they knew they were being watched. So they started doing things that were suspicious, like suddenly making U-turns in cars when the FBI was following them, or using code language on the telephone when they were talking to their friends.
And they had talked to the FBI after they came back and weren't fully truthful about what they'd done.
Which was the other problem. And in particular, on 9/11, when the attacks happened, Sahim Alwan, one of the Lackawanna Six, actually called FBI agent Ed Needham and said, you know, if there's anything I can do, I feel awful about this. Meanwhile, Ed Needham already knew mm-hmm. that he had been to the camps.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to another guest. Joining us now from member station WBFO in Buffalo is Rod Personos. He represents Yasin Tahir. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Is your client a terrorist?
Well, I think his former employee in an unsolicited call said it best when he said that Yasin is just a regular guy, the kind of guy that he would hire in his debt collection operation. The easy answer to your question is no.
Mm-hmm. He did go to a terrorist camp, though. Shouldn't
That's
he be
correct.
Punished for that?
We agree, and we agreed at the time, John, that he should be punished for that. The harshness of the penalty that was imposed, however, in our view, is disproportionate to the wrong that he committed.
And tell us where he is right now. He's in jail?
Yes, he's being held in a federal facility in Terre Haute, Indiana.
And he will be in jail for how long?
His total sentence that he received was in the 7 to 8 year range. He's got about another year and a half to 2 years to go before he'll be released.
Mm-hmm. How often do you talk to him?
Well, we don't talk at all. There are severe restrictions on his ability to communicate with the outside world. We communicate more in two ways. One is by letter, and the other is through his wife, Nicole.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your view of how the government prosecuted this case.
Well, they did a masterful job of taking advantage of the tenor of the times. It was these fellows were arrested on the one-year anniversary of the 9/11 disaster, and the government played that to the hilt. Throughout the prosecution that went on for the next year or so, they did a tremendous job of taking advantage of the mood of the country at that time.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Do you feel the government was treating these young men unfairly, taking advantage of their situation simply for political purposes?
I hesitate to say that, seeing that I represented one of these gentlemen, and at this point that makes it sound as though it's sour grapes. We had our options. We certainly could have tested this case in court if that was the decision that Yassin had made. He didn't make that decision. I hesitate to say that they were treated unfairly. I will say that I think the government did just an absolute masterful job in taking advantage of the mood of the country at that time to sway public opinion against these individuals and work that to their advantage.
Dina, do you think Yassin Tahir is representative of the Lackawanna Six? Were they all sort of the all-American story that he represents, or are there different shades of guilt?
There are definitely different shades of guilt, I think. And he was the one that was, in a lot of ways, the easiest to write about because his story was, in so many ways, the great American story, and the way he had come here and assimilated, it seemed like, into the Buffalo community or the Lackawanna community. There were other people who were within the Six. For example, Jabir El-Banna, who's a gentleman who never came back. He was a true believer when he was there at the camps. He said as much to Sahim Alwan when Sahim said to him, "Hey, I don't like the sound of this. I think we should go." He said, "No, I want to be a martyr. I'm willing to die." And he's now on a sort of what some people in the FBI call a catch-and-release program in Yemen. They sometimes grab him and arrest him, and then at other times release him. And he's on the most wanted list, the FBI's most wanted list.
We want to bring one other person into this discussion. John Miller is assistant director of the FBI in charge of public affairs. He joins us from a conference on terrorism in Europe. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
We've been talking about the Lackawanna Six and how the U.S. is dealing with the threat of homegrown terror. What part of this is your job?
Well, the Office of Public Affairs is over the Community Relations Unit of the FBI, and they are the core unit at FBI headquarters to coordinate the national outreach program to different communities, and among them the Muslim community, which we've really put the largest focus on because among all communities we do outreach to, it's the one I think we had the most challenging environment in the post 9/11 era.
And tell us a little bit about that outreach program. What do you do?
Well, it starts with the basic, which was just opening doors of communications. That wouldn't seem like a heavy lift. We have dialogue with the African American community, with Jewish organizations, with the Latino community. But with the Muslim community, as this story illustrates, there was an awful lot of suspicion, bad blood, ill feelings in the post 9/11 time over things that did happen, things that were perceived to happen. So the first part was really opening doors. Once we established that dialogue with the national groups in Washington, The rest of the effort was to reach out to the local groups from city to city and town to town across 56 field offices and see if we could replicate that dialogue on the grassroots level in the streets. And we've come an awful long way at doing that.
We want to thank you for joining us and say goodbye to Rod Personas, who is the attorney for Yassim Tahir. You're listening to Talk of the Nation on NPR News. We're back with Talk of the Nation, and today we're discussing the Jihad Next Door, the Lackawanna Six, and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. It's a new book by NPR reporter Dina Temple-Rostin. She's here with us in the studio. Also with us is John Miller, Assistant Director of the FBI in charge of Public Affairs. And we have a caller from Trenton, New Jersey, Jennifer. Welcome
Thanks
to the program.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, you have a question or a comment?
Yes, a question, actually. I'm hearing a lot more about this idea of homegrown terrorism lately in the media, so much so that I am wondering about the timing, and I'd like to ask your guests what effect they thought these concerns would have on the administration's recent attempts to increase their domestic surveillance powers and what impact that could possibly have on civil liberties.
John Miller, what do you think? Is this part of a government campaign to make sure the surveillance powers that we have stay in place or maybe get stronger?
Well, I don't subscribe to the idea that this conversation just started. I think if you go back to 2003 with the case that unfolded in Torrance, California, followed by the case that unfolded in Toledo, Ohio, followed by the two Georgia Tech students who had hooked up with the Canada 17, winding down through Miami and up through New York, the cases have demonstrated over the last 4 or 5 years this homegrown trend. So it's not a conversation that's just started.
Well, let me ask you about the way that you have handled, the difference between the way you handled the Lackawanna case and the way you handled the Fort Dix case in terms of reaching out to the Muslim community. There were significant differences there, weren't there?
I would say everything about the cases is different, and it's not that one is right and one is wrong. It's that a lot of dynamics have changed. If you go back to the time of the Lackawanna 6 case, you know, this is in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Everybody is convinced that there's a sleeper cell. All the intelligence coming over the transom says there are one or more cells ready to pounce in a second wave of attacks. So in some effect, you could liken that to a game of whack-a-mole, which is you were looking at the threat picture. Red lights were blinking all over the map, and you were trying to figure out how fast, with the legal powers that we have, can we shut down these cells either on charges related to terrorism or other criminal activity so that we reduce the threat. Now you fast forward 5 or 6 years, and you come into the time of the JFK plot, the Fort Dix plot, and you see two things have developed. One, they look at the investigations differently because now after 4 or 5 years of gathering intelligence, comparing notes, and getting a richer picture of the environment out there, I think they look at these cases as let's go much more slowly, let's gather much more string, bring in much more information about the players. Who are they? Are they part of a network? What are their connections before they take a case down? At the same time, I think we are much more sensitive to the sensitivities of the community. So when a case like that goes forward, my people are on the phone, the people from the local FBI field office are on the phone to the community groups, both the national groups and the local groups, saying something is unfolding right now and your phones are going to light up with questions and concerns from the community. Let us give you all the information we can about it, and if you have more questions, come back to us. That's also pretty different.
Mm-hmm. And you did. Do you think you did a better job of that in the Fort Dix case than you did early, you know, in 2006 during the Lackawanna case?
Well, I wasn't here at the time of the Lackawanna case. I can't speak to the specific community outreach, except to say that that the office up there has been one of the leading offices in community outreach, and must have been doing something right in that the information on the Lackawanna 6 actually came from the community. But I think we have a much more systematic approach to doing that reach out, even before we when we execute a search warrant in a sensitive location, be it a charity, a mosque, a home of a member of the community. There is a lot of planning that goes into how to do it so that we don't deliberately offend sensitivities. There's a lot of outreach that goes that follows that, where we reach out to the community and say, this is what happened, this is what didn't happen, here's the information that we can give you. So a lot of thought goes into that now, because we realize we have to have a partnership with that community, and they realize that too. And the major groups have been very willing to be a part in this effort. I don't think they get much credit for it.
Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina, where Justin is waiting with a question. Hello, Justin. Hello, Justin. Are you there?
Absolutely. How you doing?
Doing well. Welcome to the program. You've got a question for us?
I initially had a question for the lawyer, but I guess my real question is, it seems like even the author of the book and the lawyer seems to think that you're not a terrorist until you actually commit a terrorist act. So where is the fine line of what a terrorist is or isn't? Going to a foreign country, you're training to kill people and to kill Americans, but yet they're not terrorists? I'm a little confused.
Mm-hmm. Well, they weren't training to kill Americans, and the Lackawanna Six actually went to the camp before 9/11, and one of the themes of the book is whether or not they really understood what it was that they were getting into. I think they thought they were going to be sort of Muslim jihadists who maybe would fight in Chechnya or Bosnia. So Chechnya against the Russians, you know, Bosnia against people they felt were against Muslims there. And their intention was not to come back here and attack the United States. As a matter of fact, they left the camps early because when they realized that this was an anti-American operation, or parts of it were, they wanted nothing to do with it.
But terrorists kill others than Americans.
I understand that, but they actually never did anything. And when they went to the camps, I'm not sure they entirely understood what those camps were about. And see, we have hindsight now. Post 9/11, we all know about Osama bin Laden. We all know about the camps. We know what Al-Qaeda is all about. And, you know, as people who read newspapers, we may be more aware of world affairs. These were 20-something guys who made 20-something-year-old guys who made some bad decisions. And I'm not sure that they knew what we know now. And that's why I said in the beginning of the program, there's a huge bright line between people who went to these kind of camps before 9/11 and those that went after. I think the intention is totally different.
Thanks very much, Justin.
Okay, thank you.
John Miller, any comment? Do you have to commit a terrorist act to be a terrorist?
Well, I think if you look at what they were charged with, what they pled guilty to, it didn't have to do with committing a terrorist act. It had to do with aiding a terrorist organization, to wit, going to the camp and attending and training. And I'm going to rely on their guilty pleas as the statement of fact.
Mm-hmm. How concerned are you about Muslim radicalization in the United States, Mr. Miller?
Well, it's obviously a concern if you look back through those cases. It's not just a concern of the FBI. It's a concern of the community. They've talked to us about it. But when you look across how Al-Qaeda has morphed, you see how they have tried to exploit this, which is Al-Qaeda used to be a front office-run, headquarters-centric organization, like the Sopranos, if you will. Bin Laden was the boss. Zawahiri was the underboss. Captains ran crews or cells around the world. What happened in the post 9/11 era was it really used the internet to push out its message and to call on people to accept that message, to step up and to be committed. And as we've seen from Los Angeles to Miami to Chicago to New York to Georgia, is that people have taken that message seriously, have plotted to do terrorist acts on U.S. soil, with no more ability to find Al-Qaeda than Al-Qaeda had to find them. But they found each other through the wide net that was cast on the internet. You've got a case in London involving a gentleman named Yunus Tasuli, who on the other end of his computer, he had the group in Canada, the group in Georgia, a group in Denmark, and all of them had different plots up in the air when this was taken down by a worldwide group of law enforcement agencies that were all comparing notes. Again, not Al-Qaeda, just Al-Qaeda-centric. So it's a growing movement.
Thanks for your time, John Miller.
And thanks for having me.
John Miller is Assistant Director of the FBI in charge of public affairs. He joined us by phone from Europe. Dina Temple-Raston, thank you very much. Her new book is The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six, and The Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.